another installment of the things that are pissing me off. All right, so where do we start? I think we can start now. I'm not taking any requests from people. It's difficult for me to manage it. Usually what I've done in the past, I have opened it up for everyone in the general session, but I usually take Q&As from my subscribers. So if you want a more intimate one-on-one, or not one-on-one, but to ask questions, then please subscribe for what amounts to be a latte. So for 1 month of exclusive content, you can support people who are putting things on the line. Okay, let's start with number one. I didn't know who this guy was until some people started tagging me saying, oh my God, you have an Egyptian twin. And so then I looked into the guy, saw him on Piers Morgan, saw him more recently on Trigonometry. I'm talking about Bassem Youssef, who is apparently an Egyptian, I think, television host or stand-up comic or something like that, who, as I said, I didn't know much about him, but then I saw him on Piers Morgan. He started pissing me off. And then I said, okay, well, let me really dig in here and give the guy a chance, because I don't want to criticize someone, obviously, if I haven't had a chance to sit down and listen to him. And so I actually, so that you don't have to go through the pain, I sat through, I think it was 1 hour and 2 minutes of a quote chat between the two guys from Trigonometry, whom I really appreciate. They've invited me on their show a few times. And Konstantin Kissin has been on my show. Great guys. Their platform has grown. But they got nowhere, because to summarize, and by the way, some of you may have seen the satirical piece that I did yesterday, whereby I pretended that I was interviewing Bassem, but really in both instances it was me. And the only way that you would know that it wasn't me, that it was him, is when he was lifting weights. I was kind of lifting my wife's, what is it called, kettlebell. And basically, to summarize his position, Israelis are genocidal maniacs. They've been engaged in a daily genocide for the past 75 plus years. They've kept Palestinians in an open concentration camp. And that's it. There is nothing else to be discussed. October 7th, Shmoktober 7th. Yes, maybe there might have been a bit of bad play on the Palestinian part, but it's totally understandable because the Israelis have been committing a daily genocide and so on and so forth. The reason why a guy like that pisses me off, because that's exactly why you can't have productive conversations with these types of folks, right? I'm hardly one to invoke, quote, nuance in all contexts. There are cases where there is no nuance when it comes to theory of evolution. The evidence is unassailable. There's 150 plus years of evidence in support of the theory of evolution. And yes, we can still debate specific elements of, there are all kinds of very valuable debates that take place within the field of evolution. But I don't debate creationists. I don't debate folks from intelligent design. Not because I'm arrogant and they're beneath me. It's because I know for a fact that no amount of evidence that I can ever offer you would get you to even consider the evidence, right? So if some of you who are familiar with my work, and certainly who are familiar with Chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind, I talk about the building of nomological networks of cumulative evidence, which is an epistemological technique whereby you collect evidence, from across many cultures, many eras, many species, many methodologies, many theoretical frameworks, all of which triangulate to demonstrate that your position is the vertical one. Well, if someone is never going to grant you the courtesy of listening to that information, then no amount of mind vaccine is going to alter their positions. And this is why some of you may have heard me recently say that I was recently asked on a show hosted by a British psychiatrist, what is the thing that I have found most surprising about human nature or about human, you know, human behavior or human cognition in my 30 years as a professor? And so I thought for a minute and I said, well, the inability of people to change their minds once they are deeply anchored in a position. And so the problem with someone like Bassem Youssef, beyond being a profoundly lobotomized moron, is that he doesn't have any epistemic humility, right? There's no capacity for him to say, well, you know what, you may have some valuable viewpoints that you can hopefully present, and okay, let's have a good conversation. He's got 3-4 points, which he just keeps repeating. The Israelis, the juice. Egyptians don't say, you know, Jews. They say juice, the juice, or the Bible, right? There's no P in Arabic. So the Palestinian Bible are being killed by the juice. And so it's impossible to talk to a guy like that. And so I was kind of pissed off because I thought, I understand the whole idea of, believe me, I've had guests on my show that I thought, you know, we're less than honest interlocutors, and because of the norm of hospitality, you know, I've been very nice to them and polite, so I don't put on my full honey badger mindset when I host someone, because I understand that if you're inviting someone to be your guest, you know you have to be, I mean, you can challenge them, but you know there has to be a certain decorum. So I get that. But I don't think that that means that you give someone a complete carte blanche in terms of allowing them to repeatedly just spew like a completely lobotomized idiot, you know, the juice, they're killing the Palestinian Bible. Okay, I mean, okay, we got it, right? The Jews are evil, the Palestinians are noble, there is absolutely nothing that the Palestinians have ever done other than, you know, repeatedly seek to eradicate the juice from the Middle East via 5 military wars started by Arabs to eradicate, to exterminate the Jews. But in any case, so that's number one. Now that relates to something that I've also talked about elsewhere, the cult of faux niceness. Okay. Some of you who have read my latest book on happiness, in one of the chapters, this is the sad truth about happiness, in one of the chapters, I talk about the universal law of optimal flourishing. I argue it's the inverted U, right? Too little of something is not good, too much of something is not good, and the sweet spot is somewhere in the middle, which, of course, Maimonides, the Jewish philosopher, knew. Of course, Aristotle knew via his golden mean. And the Nicomachean Ethics, he talks about, you know, if a soldier is too cowardly, that's not good. If he's too reckless in his bravery, then he becomes a martyr. And so the optimal point is somewhere in the middle. And in the chapter, I really hope, by the way, the book is coming out on paperback on May 14th. Please consider pre-ordering it. It really is a fun book, ancient wisdoms coupled with contemporary science and my personal trajectory of happiness. Put it all together in a stew, and you get, I think, a really fun, positive book. So please consider pre-ordering it. It'll be out on May 14th. In any case, in that chapter on the inverted U, I demonstrate that the inverted U applies across a bewildering number of situations, right? So, for example, I talk about how perfectionism, which is a personality trait, follows the inverted U. If you're not at all perfectionist, then your work will suffer because you don't have any attention to details. On the other hand, if you're too perfectionist, as I am, then you end up spending way too much time rechecking your work to make sure that there isn't a comma that's out of place. Some of you even see when I go back and correct. I mean, now I've got the edit function with my tweets, but in the past I would always put, you know, a asterisk because there's some typo or something. It totally freaks me out. And so, like most things in life, the inverted U explains that sweet spot. Now, why am I saying all this? Because when it comes to what I call the cult of faux niceness, I mean, yes, being nice is beautiful. I mean, if I may speak of myself, I'm someone who's very warm, very affectionate, very nice, but I can also be a honey badger. I can also be combative. I can, right? Everything should be tempered. Everything should be at the sweet spot, right? So infinite niceness across all situations can't be the optimal way to live, right? So for example, what if you're a pacifist under all circumstances, right? There is no context under which I'm going to pick up arms because, you know, I believe that we should raise cucumbers with love and we should, you know, hug tomatoes so that they could be maximally juicy and, you know, peace through reggae. And so if I'm a maximal pacifist and then here comes the Nazis coming to rape our tribe, well, then maybe pacifism is not such a great thing, right? The history of the world is shaped by people on both sides of the river who were willing to fight for whatever resource that we're going to fight for. If one group was pacifist while the other one was, warmonger, then the dynamic is pretty, you don't need to be a fancy evolutionist to get that. And so the reason why I despise the cult of faux niceness is because a lot of people think, here I'm going to talk about someone that I, for a very brief period of time, several months ago, came on my radar, and until I was preparing for today's session, you know, he hadn't been much on my radar anymore. This guy, Lex Fridman, some of you know, he exemplifies that mentality. No matter what, the reason I thought of him is because Bassem Youssef, the guy that I mentioned under item one of what's pissing me off these days, he went on his show. And Lex Fridman, as far as I know, is Jewish. But of course, Lex Fridman operates on a plane that's above all of you cretins and plebs and miscreants and deplorables and the great unwashed. He's just so nice. He's just so kind. Love is love. Love will conquer all. You know, we really need to find a way to spread more love. Now, in some banal grade 3 kind of way, yes, of course, love is love. And of course, as a default value, be kind until someone comes to do harm to your child, until someone comes to rape your wife, until someone comes to steal your belonging, in which case, you shouldn't be nice, right? And so we have what's called behavioral plasticity. We can change our behavior depending on the situational demands at play in a given moment. I can tuck my children to bed and hence be very loving as a father, but I can also be violent if you attack me in an alley to rape me, right? So the love and love bullshit that this degenerate keeps spreading, I can't understand why it is that he's built it. It's a mystery. By the way, I've had many, many very well-known people write to me privately and say, "Gad, what's the scam that's going on that this guy's been able to build such a platform?" And I don't know the answer to that. Because if you try to listen to him, I've tried to listen and I can't get past, 30 seconds before I think about going into a murderous jihad. Because it's, love is love and who are we to judge? And I love you and you love me. And we should love the Palestinians and the Jews should be loved. And the Nazis deserve loving and we're all here to love one another. You're a moron. Come live in my childhood for 5 seconds in the Middle East and then spread this bullshit. So it's either that he is profoundly idiotic, like he literally has the brain of a 3-year-old, or it's just a shtick, I believe in spreading love. Now, by the way, he says, I want to talk to everybody. I'm willing to have a conversation with everybody. The minute that I had challenged him a few months ago when he had said some insanely idiotic thing on his tweets, and I did it reasonably politely with some spice, with some Gad spice, but, polite. I didn't swear at him or didn't call him any names. He blocked me forevermore. So, Bassem Youssef's pissing me off. The cult of faux niceness is pissing me off. Now, let's come to another topic, which I did discuss in The Parasitic Mind, related to what we're talking about here. This ethos of, I don't judge. Who are we to judge? How should we judge? Who am I to judge? Motherfucker, judge. Okay, right? There is a field called judgment and decision making. Right? We judge. When we go out on dates, we judge between the different people that we're going to potentially marry. When we are choosing between candidates to hire at a company, we judge. So the prescription of don't judge that you see, and I discuss all this in a lot of details in The Parasitic Mind, this prescription of, you know, don't judge, yes, you know, ye be judged, it comes from the idea of moral hypocrisy. It comes from the idea of, you know, clean your house before you go out and cast judgment on others, right? Don't be a moral hypocrite. That's what that prescription means. It means don't be a hypocrite in criticizing others when, you know, it's the old, you know, don't throw stones, you know, in a glass house and so on. It's not a deontological prescription of don't ever judge, right? Which, by the way, relates to another idea pathogen in the parasitic mind that I talk about, which is cultural relativism. Who are we to judge what other cultures do? That's cultural imperialism. No. Cutting off the clitorises of five-year-old girls is not a good thing. And I'm going to judge you, asshole. Okay? So again, that's a form of weak, effeminate castration, whereby you say, I don't have a sufficient moral spine to cast judgment on reprehensible behaviors that others commit. Who am I to judge? Again, it's correlated to this cult of faux niceness, all of which will be addressed fully in what likely might be my next book, which is a book on suicidal empathy, right? Empathy, again, is an emotion that has evolved for very clear adaptive reasons, but it's only adaptive when it is invoked in the right manner, at the right place, to the right target. When it becomes hyperactive, it becomes a form of suicidal empathy. When it is hyperactive in ways that will result in the death of your society, that's why it's called suicidal empathy. And Elon Musk was kind enough to retweet several of my tweets a couple of weeks ago where I was talking about suicidal empathy. And I think they got something, obviously because Elon has such a huge platform, it got something like, I don't know, 60 million views or something. And so I definitely think that there is a real market for such a book. It really would be a natural sequel to The Parasitic Mind. And the tweets that I had put out had been really well received, so much so that a executive editor of one of the major publishers wrote to me privately and said, there's your next book, let's talk. And so I'm putting together a short book prospectus that will hopefully serve as the roadmap for my next book. So stay tuned for that. Another book that I was hoping to write, which might lead us to segue to the next thing that's pissing me off. It's something that's been pissing me off for a few years now, taxes. So I had written a tweet a while ago saying, look, I've been wanting to write a book on parasitic taxation and another bigger book on the parasitic state. Which book do you think I should write? And then Elon had written right back and said, both. And so I already actually got an offer to write the book. I got a book deal to write the parasitic state book, which would include a section on parasitic taxation. Now, why am I talking about this today? Well, first of all, I know that April 15th is tax day in the U.S. In Canada, it's a slightly different schedule. But some of you may have seen earlier today, there was the announcement that the castrato-in-chief, Justin Trudeau, has increased capital gains tax, I think over $250,000 to 67, has increased it by 67% or something to that effect. Now, by the way, you know, I don't make capital gains that is the order of $250,000. So if I'm pissed, it's not because that particular increase in tax affects me personally. But again, it's the principle. How much can you, and I know some of the economic arguments, so it's in a sense it's a more philosophical question. How much can you actually go and tax people before they have the very moral obligation to take you out into the street and execute you for being, just a, I don't have the word, I mean, the level of institutionalized criminality whereby, so just to give you a sense, some of you may have heard me mention this before, in Quebec, the highest marginal tax rate is at 25% of your income. And at the federal level, it's 33%. So now, and you know, both are taxed. So you could be, so if you're making over a certain amount, you're taxed well into the high 50%, 58%, okay, as a marginal tax rate, okay? Now, whatever money is left for you, which means, you know, let's go with about 40%, 42%, 44% of what you started off making. There are two sales tax in Canada. There is a Quebec, a provincial sales tax, and then there is a federal sales tax. So if I've made $10 and you've taxed me $58, I'm left with $42. Now, I'd like at that point, I could say, hey, you've taken more than 50% of what I've earned. And in my case, my earnings, my big earnings, don't come from my salary as a professor. They come from stuff that I've done beyond being a professor, writing books, giving talks, and so on, creating content. And all of that very, very private, right? I mean, private in the sense that it's coming straight out of my neuron. It's coming, you're taxing my mind. You're taxing my words. You're taxing my personal history that I describe from my days in Lebanon. That doesn't belong to me. 58% of that belongs to you. Now, you would say at that point, you know what? We've taxed this person enough. We can't tax anymore. No. The 42% that you're left with, if you go out and spend money, that's taxed at 15%. There are two taxes in Canada, sales taxes. There's a provincial and a federal one. So now add 15% on the money that you were left with after they took away much more than 50% of your income. Okay, but it doesn't stop there. How about property tax? How about school tax? How about now the carbon tax, which now Justin Trudeau has increased. Now you add, you're increasing the capital gain. So somebody goes out, invests in real estate, makes a lot of money. They've already given you tons and tons of money, more money than 10,000 Canadians will together. Doesn't matter. Now we'll tax you at an increased rate of 67%, right? So the reason why that system can never go away, because it's the ultimate Ponzi scheme. Because for that system to operate, you need very few people to fund the parasitic socialist unicornia for all other people. So if 95% of people in Canada benefit from this brutal criminal taxation system, they're never going to stand up and say, hey, stop this. This is morally wrong. What will they say? Fuck that Jew Gatzad. Tax him more, that asshole with his fancy books. He doesn't pay enough. Sure, he pays more than 1,000 Canadian families. By the way, if you saw the income that I make from all my stuff and then what I'm left with at the end of the year, you'd say it's absolutely impossible. There's no way. You're lying, Gad. Because you would say, oh my God, my goodness, you really are in the top 1%. And then you'd say, so what's the net thing? How much at the end of the year, you have a few children, you know, however much that costs. So what are you left with? My goodness, you must be Lebanese Elon Musk. And then you go, oh boy, what? You're left with a couple of thousand dollars? Well, yeah. If think of it another way, some of you may like this this other way of thinking about taxes. So imagine if you lived in a place where there was 0% tax. That means all the money that you make from January 1st to December 31st is yours. Okay. Another way to look, let's say the government takes 50% of your income. That means from January 1st to end of June, you work for the government the first 6 months, and then only the seventh month you start keeping your money. Is it normal that in Canada I start making money around August, around September? So in other words, if we use the very ugly reality of slavery, where you're 100% taxed, right? You have no right to any remuneration. You're a slave. That means from January 1st to December 31st, your labor is owned by someone else. You're a slave. It's your master who owns you. Well, Canada, I am only a quote-free man beginning in August. Is that a fair system? So frankly, while I always want to say, oh, well, thank you, Canada, for letting us come into your country when we were escaping the Lebanese Civil War, how much of my money and my children's future wealth should I pay you as a thank you for having let us in 1975? And by the way, 40% of Canadians don't pay the, I can't remember if it's the federal taxes or any taxes. It really is. I mean, if you look at the percentage of people who don't pay any taxes versus the percentage of the total tax load that is paid by, say, the 5% of the population, it is astounding. It's criminal. It's immoral. It's unethical. But again, you can't fight it. Because how could you fight something that benefits 95% of the people? So you're the sucker that funds everybody else. By the way, oh, the healthcare system in Canada? My wife, who's lived in Canada since 1979, who's paid taxes, who's been a productive citizen, can't get a personal physician. Can't get one. It took me a while because I didn't like my former physician. For me to find another one took forever. And it's only through connections, because one of my former MBA students is himself a physician, that I was able to get to switch to another physician. In the US, you have this romantic vision of free healthcare in Canada. There's nothing free about it. It's free to the person who doesn't pay taxes. But I pay for 10,000 Canadians for their free healthcare. I'm the one who subsidizes it. So I write a book, you steal all the royalties to give you the free healthcare. Why is it that I should pay? For example, Mark Cuban, a few days ago, I suppose he did it proudly, said, well, here is the bill that I just paid, I don't know what it was, $288 million to the IRS. Some people got upset at him. They said, well, you just sold your shares in the Dallas Mavericks for $3.5 billion. So you paid something like 8% on it. Well, okay, we can discuss whether he should have paid more than 8% or not. But really, an individual should pay $288 million for the right to be an American citizen while millions of other people don't pay a cent? What's the deontological principle that says that that's ethical? There isn't. The only way that that's okay is when you believe there is something inherently, ontologically unfair about one person being richer, wealthier than another person, and therefore you redistribute that money. It's unfair that one person is a billionaire and another is not, and therefore we will take your money so that we create a more equitable society. But as E.O. Wilson famously said when asked about socialism and communism, remember he's an entomologist who studies social ants, he said about communism, great idea, wrong species, right? There is nothing moral about one person paying a million times more for the exact same government services. Does he use the fire department more? Does he use the healthcare more? Does he get more police protection? Does he get better healthcare? No, nothing, right? It's unfair that one, right? What does Elon Musk pay in terms of taxes? I don't know. I think it was $11 billion or some crazy number. I don't see that as, well, that's unfair. He should be taxed more. No, Elon Musk, through, I mean, we some of you may have seen our chat recently. We had a chat on X Spaces, Elon and I, and when I asked them about, you know, how much of entrepreneurship is nature versus nurture, you know, he answered it, and then he said, well, a lot of it is just luck, which of course is true. So whether it be through his brilliance, whether it be through luck, he didn't steal what he achieved. He did it because he's a visionary. Whatever skills that he has, yeah, maybe some of it is luck, but he certainly is an incredibly talented guy who's amassed this huge fortune. Guess what? He deserves it. And no, he shouldn't have to pay billions and billions of dollars because, you know, fairness. He pays more than enough. He pays more in a year than the entire country pays. I mean, so to speak, I didn't do the math, but you get what I'm saying. There's nothing fair about that. Again, the only thing that allows you to invoke the argument of bullshit fairness is if you believe that people should inherently be equal in their outcomes. And therefore, if one person is worth $200 billion while another person doesn't have enough to eat, that's unfair. Well, it's unfair that Messi plays better soccer than any person that's ever lived on earth. But that's why he gets paid where he gets paid. By the way, this is why the women's soccer leagues says it is unfair. They filed a lawsuit. How come collectively, all of us put together, we don't make the same salary as Lionel Messi? Well, could it be because you suck compared to Lionel Messi? There's this little thing called the market realities, whereby people are willing to pay huge sums of money to watch Messi, but nobody gives a shit about watching you. No, that must be because of misogyny. So this mindset is a cancer. It's a cancer to innovation. It's a cancer to human dignity. It's a cancer to excellence. It's a cancer to meritocracy. So yeah, I'm pissed about taxes. It sucks. In a right system, and you know, maybe if I end up writing this book on, you know, the parasitic state and parasitic taxation, I'll expand on this. But in my view, it's just everybody pays one flat tax, not even flat rate, not we all pay 10%, because 10% of a billion is still a lot more than if you make 100,000. When you go to a car dealer, the car dealership, as a matter of fact, it's illegal. He doesn't say, oh, show me your tax returns. Oh, you made $4 million last year? The Toyota is going to cost you $487,000. Oh, you only made $37,000? I'll give it to you for 12 bucks, right? The price is the price. So yes, we all have to contribute to the collective good. We all, you know, the government can't operate without funds, and therefore, for the privilege of being Canadian or being American or whichever country, other country we live in, let's pay $10,000. Okay, you don't like that idea? Fine, then let's pay a flat rate, 9%, 5%, 10%, and that's it. And by the way, there has to be a limit. So for example, I strongly believe, now we can also talk about not having an income tax, but it could be a consumption tax, right? You pay only when you spend something. And many people have proposed that argument. Perhaps most famously, Bob Frank, who's a economist at my alma mater at Cornell, but there are many other economists who've proposed a similar thing. Again, there's no reason as to why one person should be paying, you know, 1,000, 10,000 times more than other people, most of whom actually pay zero taxes. In Canada, as I said, up to 40% of people don't pay any taxes. That can't be right. And again, I'd like to think that at some point people will say, my goodness, how did we tolerate this? Okay, so that's that. Since we're talking about taxes, we're talking about Canada, let me just briefly off the top of my head, just reiterate how much I despise Justin Trudeau. He exemplifies every trait that I find defines an execrable cretin. He's smug. He's ignorant. He's arrogant. He's feminized. He's woke. He's imbecilic. He's parasitic. I mean, he He's lazy. He's entitled. His highest professional attainment prior to entering into politics on the back of his obnoxious daddy's name, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, was that Justin Trudeau was a substitute drama teacher, not a full-fledged physics and math high school teacher. He was a substitute drama teacher. And now he decides how much money I keep. He decides whether my children have a financially secure future, because he knows better, because he's rolling up his sleeves and he's doing the hard work for Canadians. And the way he does that is he sees all those wealthy, successful people and he says, pay your fair share, assholes. And by that, I mean, make sure that everybody is equally destitute so we can live in equal misery. He's vile. He's grotesque. He's Dunning-Kruger, right? Arrogant in his ignorance. He can't put two words together. All right, so that's that. Final thing that's pissing me off. Life coaches. I wrote an article a few years ago. At the time, I used to have an active Psychology Today column. I think I wrote in total, I began in 2008, my Psychology Today column. And I wrote, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember the number, 311 articles, probably over 200,000 words, which is the equivalent of maybe, I guess, three full-length books. Originally, I started writing Psychology Today because in 2008, when I was starting to think, you know, I'd like to write for, you know, the masses, my first couple of books, you know, were academic books. Academic books, that doesn't mean textbook. Academic books means you're writing it for other academics. These are, you know, technical books. And so, for example, my first book, The Evolutionary Basis of Consumption, was a hardcore technical book, academic book, where I was trying to demonstrate how you could apply evolutionary psychology in, you know, consumer behavior. And then I edited a book called Evolutionary Psychology in the Business Sciences, which was also an academic book. But then my first trade book was The Consuming Instinct, which was meant to be a book, you know, a trade book to be read by the masses. And so in 2008, a few years before my first trade book came out, I wanted to start writing for the masses because, you know, when you write scientific papers, that doesn't mean that your voice will resonate as well with the public. I mean, I had a healthy dose of self-confidence about my being able to reach the masses. But I thought, you know what, if I maybe accept the invitation of Psychology Today to start writing for them, well, that's a wonderful way to gauge whether I'm writing in a style that appeals to people, which is, that's because Psychology Today is read by the masses. And so one of the articles that I had written of those 311 articles was an article where I actually critiqued life coaches. And the reason that came up, by the way, some of you may be thinking, oh, but wait a minute, you just wrote a happiness book. Isn't that a form of, you know, life coaching? No, not at all. Because first of all, I've got the credentials to back up what I'm saying. My book is taking ancient wisdoms, taking contemporary science, taking my long personal history and saying, hey, here are some prescriptions that could augment the probability of you being happy. In other words, I'm very epistemically humble in what I promise. I don't say, here are the six ways to give your wife an orgasm every time you touch her, right? Every single of these self-help books usually promises you the world, right? You know, how to reverse aging, how to be the best lover in the world, how to make millions, the secret, right? The visualization board. It's all bullshit. I talk about it in The Consuming Instinct. I have a whole chapter on, you know, peddling hope, right? That's what you do. So life coaches, now I'm not implying that every life coach is full of shit, but, well, 99% are. unlike, say, clinical psychology or psychiatry, where you have to go through a very, very long process of getting credentials, right? If you're a psychiatrist, you're getting an undergraduate degree, then you're getting a medical degree, then you're training as a psychiatrist. If you want to become a clinical psychologist, you're getting an undergrad, a master's, a PhD in clinical psychology. You're doing an internship in a hospital and so on. It's going to take you 10 plus years to get the right training to even pretend to be able to offer advice to people. By the way, that was one of the reasons why I was a bit hesitant to write the happiness book, because I thought, well, wait a minute. I mean, how to live the good life is probably the topic that has been most written about by philosophers. Am I going to be able to offer something unique, insightful, powerful? And I'd like to think that I have. Hopefully you'll read it and you'll let me know. But, you know, I was very cognizant of that fact, and I wanted to make sure that any advice that I give you is going to be contextualized as a probabilistic statement, right? If you do X, Y, Z, the likelihood of you finding a right spouse increases. But life is stochastic, right? There is nothing guaranteed. I can offer, you know, so I can tell you, you know, between birds of a feather flock together or opposites attract. When it comes to mate choice, the research shows that overwhelmingly it's birds of a feather flock together that is operative, meaning that if you find a spouse with whom you share the foundational values and beliefs, similar life goals, mindsets, that's going to much more increase your chances of being. So again, it's a probabilistic statement. So everything that I wrote in this book is well documented by ancient wisdoms, by contemporary science in many different disciplines, by my vast personal experience. So I'm humble about what I can offer you. Life coaches, all right, I'm 498 pounds. I can't tie my shoes, but I'm a life coach of nutrition and health. How the fuck did that happen? Well, because there is no credentials to be a life coach. Everybody's a life coach. The squirrel in my backyard is a life coach, right? I've already been divorced 18 times, but I'm a relationship coach, okay? I filed for 18 personal bankruptcies, but I am a personal finances coach, right? So in a sense, everybody is a coach, right? If it's like saying, you know, everybody is a aspiring filmmaker. Everybody is an aspiring author. You know, they just haven't gone through the trouble of writing the book. But, you know, I'm an author. Everybody's an author. I'm a poet. Okay. So life coaches, one big racket. Now, again, that doesn't mean that every single quote. By the way, why is it called life coach, not psychologist? Because, oh, wait a minute. Psychologist requires me going to university for 10 years, 12 years. Oh, psychiatrist requires me going to school for many years. Life coach, I just sign up in my local How to Hug Cucumbers seminar at the local Ramamagish school, and I become a relationship life coach. I become a sex life coach. I become a nutrition life coach. Not a nutritionist. Once I put the words life coach, then all bets are off. No need for credentials, right? So it's a scam. It's bullshit. Okay. So let's recap. What are the things that have pissed me off today? Bassem Youssef. The Palestinian people are being killed by the Jews. Okay. The cult of faux niceness. I'm okay. You're okay. We're all in love. There would no longer be war if we all treat each other with kindness. Exactly. The reason why the Middle East has been mired in endless wars is because they haven't listened to Lex Friedman's pontifications about niceness. If only the Palestinians and Israelis would really delve into his podcast, then the Middle East would be resolved. Because I'm okay, you're okay. The I don't judge cult is full of shit. Judge. That's okay. It's healthy to judge. I will judge you. That's why, by the way, you know who are the most interesting people in the world? People who are opinionated. People who judge. Imagine if I were to always go, Who am I to judge? All religions are equal. Who am I to say? I don't know anything. I'm a fence sitter. The world is not shaped by fence sitters. The world is shaped by people who take unequivocal positions. Not uninformed positions, but positions that they could defend, right? Christopher Hitchens is Christopher Hitchens because he was an eloquent honey badger. He took positions. You agreed with him, you disagreed with him, but he took positions. Even the biggest diabolical monsters throughout human history are not fence sitters. They may have diabolical positions, but they're not fence sitters. Winston Churchill is not a fence sitter. Chamberlain is a castrated fence sitter. Maybe if I just spread love to Hitler, maybe he won't attack anyone. Maybe if I give him a deep tissue massage while we listen, Hitler and I, to Lex Friedman pontificating about love is love. I don't judge biological sex. I only want to know if you're a good human. Yeah, fuck off. How about that? Okay. So judge. It's natural to judge. And then taxes is parasitic. It's evil. It's diabolical. It's institutionalized criminality. Hey, by the way, the mafia engages in illegal extortion because it comes to your store, your retail store, and says, hey, Johnny, in order for there not to be an unfortunate fire in your restaurant, how about you give us a 3-6% protection tax? That's illegal. You see, that was illegal. Even if they do provide you that service, even if they make sure that the neighborhood is safe and no one's going to commit crimes against you because the mafia is running the show, that's illegal. But if Justin Trudeau and the Quebec government come and say, how about you give me 58% of your book royalties, all of which were made not in Canada, because it's a U.S. publisher that I have, but I'm a moron who declares everything and doesn't protect it in some place in the Cayman. And then I go, oops, what happened to all my book royalties? How come I don't have any money? Well, because when the government takes it, it's legal. When the mafia takes 1/20th of that amount, that's illegal. Got that? And then finally, I said that life coaches are largely full of shit. And that's true. Oof, I feel maybe a bit of catharsis. Maybe a bit. I'm feeling a bit better. Guys, if you wish to have conversations where I take your Q&A, please consider subscribing. Again, I think, I don't know if it's $5 or $6. Oh, by the way, the $6 that you pay to subscribe to my exclusive content, before we talk about taxes, Apple and the rest of the fees, they take 50%. So you give me $6, I'm only left with $3. Of the $3, Justin Trudeau and François Legault take most of it. So out of the $6 you give me, I'm probably left with about 75 cents. So I'm hardly going to get Elon Musk rich in you subscribing to the content, but at least it could monetize some of my time and expertise. Hope you had a good time. I usually, what I do after this is I eventually post these. I mean, the recording is up on the webs on, you know, on X, but then I will also post them on my YouTube channel and on my podcast. Thanks everybody for listening. Thank you for coming. I understand that this was impromptu. Anybody who did end up coming, I hope that you enjoyed it. Take care, everybody. Cheers.